Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. CRISPR, since we last talked about it, has won a Nobel Prize for the two scientists who first figured how to apply the miracle molecule to the human genome and the human condition. And just this week, from our guest, the tireless biographer Walter Isaacson, CRISPR gets heroic treatment in hardcovers for the same breakthrough biologist. For most of us, the acronym CRISPR is code for the deepest issues we don't know how to talk about. But Walter Isaacson could change that some. I think of him as the irresistible storyteller about the kinds of people Apple puts on its Think Different billboards. Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, Apple's own Steve Jobs, and back a few centuries, Leonardo da Vinci, the original Renaissance man. The new Isaacson epic, titled The Codebreaker, centers on the first woman and only the second living person in Isaacson's Hall of Fame. His subtitle is Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing and the Future of the Human Race. I'm asking Walter Isaacson how Dr. Doudna got us to wherever it is we're at, and then where we're going.
The first books I did were on the physics revolution, and Einstein was an exemplar of that. And that was the first half of the 20th century, and that brought us things like, you know, atom bombs and space travel and semiconductors. Likewise, the second half of the 20th century was a digital revolution based on bits, you know, binary digits that could encode things with computers and microchips and the internet. And I did that with Steve Jobs and the innovators. I think we're entering a more momentous, a grander innovation revolution. And that's the first half of the 21st century, which is the biotech revolution, where we're going to treat molecules the way we treated microchips. We're going to be able to encode them and rewrite their code so that we can make things like vaccines for the coronavirus or change our genes. And I wanted a central character that would help me tell the story. And Jennifer Doudna was great because just as a sixth grader, she had read The Double Helix, you know, Jim Watson's book about DNA structure. And she decided that she wanted to become a scientist. And her school guidance counselor said, well, girls don't become scientists. And so she persisted. And she was able early in her career to triumph in understanding RNA, understanding the structure of RNA. And with Jack Szostak, her professor at Harvard, figure out how RNA could be the molecule that began life on this planet. But then she goes on, because she's an expert on RNA, to figure out what are the components of this weird system called CRISPR that bacteria have that allows them to fight viruses. And she and Emmanuel Charpentier were able to discover the exact components you need to make a CRISPR system work. And boom, there was an aha moment, which is, oh, if we can do that, then we can program it to edit our own human genes, which a lot of other people, Feng Zhang and George Church at Harvard MIT did, all at the beginning of 2013. But she's this great central character that ties it to the history of science. And also she begins to wrestle with the moral and political implications of genetic engineering.
Which in my view is just barely beginning, the moral questions, the real ultimate questions, grandiose, momentous, of course, because it could involve all 7.5 billion people on the planet. Your title, The Codebreaker, refers to Jennifer Doudna. Your subtitle has the hook. Jennifer Doudna, Gene Editing, and the Future of the Human Race. That's all of us. The form of the story, seems to me, draws on a familiar shape of lonely searchers and their hero's journey toward discovery. But the readers, they're going to end this book shaken, I think, and a little scared at the money, the secrecy, the egos, the betrayals, the patent war, most important maybe, between Team West in Berkeley and Team East in Boston and Cambridge. Reminds you a little bit of the great Lakers-Celtics struggles back in the day. But then the fees, the patents, a lawyer who works that field says the patent lawyers will take $100 million for this fight over who owns CRISPR. And in a way, that's just the beginning of the big questions. How did you feel getting that deep into almost a war?
Well, I do think it's very important that we allow people who discover things to have, you know, patents and intellectual property, because that's what funds this incredibly expensive basic research. But when coronavirus came along, they put aside trying to patent and doing intellectual property. And both Feng Zhang and his lab at the Broad Institute and Jennifer Doudna and her lab out at Berkeley turned their attention to using these new technologies to detect the coronavirus, to find ways to use these new molecular technologies to fight viruses.
I have to sound a little bit skeptical. I mean, the most famous person in this whole field, more famous than Jennifer Doudna, is the famous Dr. Hu, the Chinese doctor who freelanced the editing of two human embryos and brought them to life. This is 2 years ago in China. We haven't seen the babies or Dr. Hu since then. He was cast out by the global profession, including China, and he may well be still serving time for what he confessed to be a serious crime.
Well, yeah, but he's in jail, and he was not a great researcher. He showed how easy it is to use CRISPR to edit human embryos, and they're definitely rogue players. They're rogue players in every field, but Jennifer Doudna is not one of them, nor is Feng Zhang.
No, of course not. But Dr. Hu demonstrated, among other things, that lots and lots of people can do this on their own, virtually in their garages. And the moratorium on the work that has been declared has never been enforced, and nobody's quite sure whether it would be enforced. We're still talking about a kind of Wild West for adventurers.
Well, yes, except for I do think that they have put together, with Jennifer Doudna in the lead, international groups that have decided here are the guidelines we're going to try to enforce. It's always hard to enforce guidelines, whether it's against elephant tusk trafficking or shoplifting or whatever, but there's a pretty good consensus. When she had discovered how to do this gene editing technology, she had a nightmare, and it was that she went into a room and somebody said, I want to learn about it, and it was Hitler. And that led her and people like, you know, who you know well, people like David Baltimore, Francis Collins, others, to say, let's gather people. And the Chinese have been involved, the Europeans, the Brits. But it's, you know, up to us. All of us should understand this technology and realize, by the way, there's another danger, which is that we stop it in its tracks because everybody's afraid of it. Well, then you're going to not cure these horrible genetic diseases. So we have to not be afraid of science, but we have to realize that it's only as good or as bad as we use it as a tool.
I take your point, and I have to say that I learned most of what I'm about to tell you from your book, but some of the hardest knocks on enhancement editing of genes comes from the scientists, including Jennifer Doudna. But I'm also thinking, Feng Zhang, you asked Feng Zhang, as bright and likable a man as you could meet, you asked him what's wrong with enhancing the family genes going forward. And he said, after a long pause, he said, I just don't like it. It's messing with nature. Mm-hmm. And he said it was bound to be unfair. Rich people would be allowed to buy the best genes they could afford. He said, look at what parents are willing to do to get kids into college. Some will surely pay for genetic enhancement. There's something that the scientists are worried about.
Yeah, I do think genetic enhancement and inherited genetic enhancement have two huge problems. One is that the rich will be able to buy better genes, and it'll not only take the inequality we have, it'll encode it, like in Brave New World or Gattaca. Mm-hmm. And secondly, we would be in danger if everybody could willy-nilly edit their children how they wanted. So I think you have to draw a line and say, let's use it for clear medical needs, but not for enhancements. Hmm. And on the other hand, let's not be so afraid that someday, 20, 30, 40 years from now, people will enhance, you know, the genes of the human species, that we put a stop to this ability to cure. I mean, you know, Jennifer had those feelings you talked about, and then she kept running into people saying, my kid's got cystic fibrosis. My kid's going to die of muscular dystrophy. You know, I'm suffering from Tay-Sachs. And she said, okay, it would be immoral not to use these technologies. And your friend George Church at Harvard goes even further and says, I'm not quite sure why making a kid a little bit taller or a little bit stronger or having even more IQ points, I'm not sure what the moral dilemma there is. What's wrong with that? It does make me uncomfortable when you're doing enhancements, but I don't think we should have knee-jerk reactions like people do to GMOs or whatever. Let's understand the science and then use it very cautiously when it's medically necessary.
I wish George Church were in on this conversation, Walter, because he's one of the most brilliant beyond measure, but also open, accessible, and he shares his own misgivings. I asked him, do you worry about Murphy's Law, that if something can go wrong, it will go wrong? He said, I worry about it every minute of the day.
Well, he's a wonderful character.
And a wonderful man, I think.
I remember sitting in the pubs with him eating vegetarian burgers. So I really loved having him by my side when I wrote this book.
It's only fair to say an estranged mentor of Feng Zhang. That did not go well after Feng Zhang left the lab.
Right, and I hope they all reconcile soon.
I'm also thinking, though, of the scariest, most alarming thoughts on gene editing. And first of all, we're interested for human nature because of the so-called germline editing that will pass through generations. And the scariest picture of it all comes from everybody's favorite bad guy, Vladimir Putin. Speaking to a youth festival in 2017, he said, man has the opportunity to get into the genetic code created by either nature or, as religious people would say, by God. One may imagine that scientists could create a person with desired features. This may be a mathematical genius, an outstanding musician, but this can also be a soldier, a person who can fight without fear or compassion, without mercy or pain. I mean, the stakes are beyond huge.
Yeah, the Defense Department of the United States is actually funding a lot of the research, mainly in things like anti-CRISPR, meaning ways to reverse CRISPR, and also ways to make sure that we can guard against a malevolent actor, Vladimir Putin, who creates genetically modified or engineered or edited organisms. But, you know, that's true of everything since I wrote about Albert Einstein's E equals MC squared, eventually leading people to an atom bomb. We have to be morally aware of the uses of our technology.
Coming up, who steers the fleet of ships out there in quest of CRISPR? This is Open Source. Walter Isaacson logged more time with lab principals than any journalist I know, and he got to volunteer some of his own cells for editing. I wanted to hear more about the mood, the culture, and the characters in his new world.
Well, I do think that there are four really great heroes in this book. Obviously, Jennifer Doudna, Emmanuel Charpentier, Feng Zhang, George Church. And I never quite knew what happened in a research lab day in and day out. What do people do? So I spent time both in Feng Zhang's lab, but mainly in Jennifer Doudna's lab at Berkeley. And I even edited human cells using CRISPR on my own. I actually had changed the DNA of a human cell, and there was a glowing reporter molecule, so I could make sure I did it. We mixed it with a whole lot of chlorine and washed it down the drain. I wanted to be careful I didn't unleash something in the human species. There are two main things I take away from the four people I mentioned. First of all is that they're curiosity-driven. Despite all these patent wars or whatever, the main thing driving scientists is this wonder about nature and how it works. And so that when they're in the lab, at the bench, they're always devising experiments, something our society could learn well, because usually we nowadays have an hypothesis and then we don't test it. We found editing tools that use RNA as guides, and it all comes from a young, you know, kid like Jennifer Doudna being curious about RNA and how it works.
You know, I want to say three cheers for curiosity and three cheers for the incredible intellects of these scientists. But I also want to say, who are they to be deciding the future of the human race, really?
They aren't. And that's why I wrote this book, because I don't think we should delegate it to the scientists.
Well, that's a key point.
James Watson says, if scientists don't play God, who will? Well, I try to answer that question is we will. And by we, I mean you, Christopher Lydon, and me, and everybody listening right now. we have to understand these technologies. We cannot just shy away from them and say, let the scientists figure it out.
There is a proposal out there, Sheila Jasnoff at Harvard may have made it first, but that what the world needs is an observatory, an open global observatory to consider these questions, and far beyond the scientists. North and south, east and west, black, white, every imaginable piece of the human population, including smart and not so smart. And I observe a terrific resistance to it, Walter.
You know, Sheila Jasanoff is doing great stuff because science, technology, and society is something we should all learn and be exposed to. So we don't have that resistance.
Well, let me say just anecdotally, I find it so much harder over, say, 3, 4, 5 years to reach the CRISPR scientists than to reach now the COVID scientists. It is a virtually secret monastic profession, and they don't tell you exactly what they're doing.
Well, I will say that Jennifer and Fong Zhang were very open with me, and so was Emmanuel Charpentier. So I think you're right. We have to make sure that they open up, that scientists explain how they discovered what they did and what they think the consequences are. And that's why I spent a lot of time in Berlin with Emmanuel Charpentier or in Berkeley, because they open up when you finally sit in their labs and you seem really interested.
And that's why I thank you at the outset, Walter, for opening up, making it a story, showing a lot of the human impact, the human stuff in the whole saga. At the same time, I wouldn't know where to begin to gather people who have doubts about it, who have wrestled and conquered their doubts about it. But the scale of the project, including the money, is totally asymmetrical, should we say. Not to say that it's all greed either, but the expenses in putting this thing together are, among other things, going to make it unbelievably expensive to get the benefit of CRISPR. Should it be shared? Shouldn't ownership somehow be in an international trusteeship?
Yeah, one of the things that Jennifer Doudna is doing in her lab now is taking CRISPR and really focusing on ways to make the good medical uses of it affordable. Because this past year, there's a woman named Victoria Gray from Mississippi who gets cured of sickle cell anemia by CRISPR. This is a horrible disease. It affects the poorest. It affects blacks more than whites. And it's expensive to try to cure it. And so once they've used CRISPR, she's now trying to figure out ways that we can make this very affordable. So I think that's one of the moral pursuits I admire Doudna for doing, and I try to describe in the book how we have to get there.
I want to dig more into the STS angle on this whole subject, science, technology, and society. Very broadly, they think, I would say, that science and the science industries have bitten off more than the people can let them take of this whole story. I want to be clear, I honor you for starting the conversation so openly, Walter, and I'm still looking for where we go. Sheila Jasanoff, whom we both know, has remarked to me, I said, where's the dissent? What should we know about it? She said, Chris, there is no such thing as a dissenting biologist.
Right, but there are a lot of dissenting citizens, and I think that the pushback against science, I mean, I'm not sitting here worried that we lack pushback against science. In fact, there are days I worry about the opposite.
I worry that we're not going to have a chance to talk back to the scientists or to engage them. I'm trying to think of, and I'd put it to you, if you could order up a committee, a World Blue Ribbon Committee of wisdom to review all of these questions, who would be on it? I'd want to put your man Leonardo on it.
We'd love Leonardo to be on it. So I want to make sure we all get into this discussion. And, you know, I think we have a certain sense of where the line should be, including that we don't mess with the germline, which is inheritable edits. But even then, I want some discussion, because if you're going to make the type of gene editing that will cure sickle cell anemia or Huntington's most easily, you can't do it the way it was done recently in the patient where you take the stem cells out and return them, and it's $1 million. It's better to do that as an inherited edit and get rid of sickle cell anemia if we want. But we ought to have the discussion first.
When I think of that, the long-term germline editing and who should be reviewing it for us, for all of us, for Africa, for the East, the West, I think of one man in particular, the most eminent of biologists in the world, a student of Linus Pauling, a colleague of Watson and Crick, still sharp as can be on all of these issues, and he says, caution, caution, caution. What you don't want to tamper with is what makes us human, whatever that is. He says, is it compassion? Is it curiosity? One of your strong suits. Is it kindness? Is it the ties that bind us? Are those qualities located in our biology? And in what combination of how many genes? The rule has to be caution beyond measure in our tampering. And he was saying, among other things, to say that an intervention in a genome is safe in a mouse has absolutely no bearing on the question of, is it good for our humanity, our humanness? I think he says we should all be sounding that caution to each other and to science, big science, individual science, the whole discussion.
I agree totally. And I think that there's really no justification to try to edit human traits, as in personality, as in empathy, kindness, IQ, memory, intelligence, all these things. We should not go there. And I think, you know, we should limit ourselves, at least for the next few decades, to things that are pretty straightforward, maybe even just single gene abnormalities, where if you fix them, you get a genome that's like a typical genome. You're not inventing something new. In other words, if somebody has a mutation causing sickle cell anemia, you can fix that, or you can fix the mutation causing Tay-Sachs or cystic fibrosis. But you're right. When people start saying, I'm going to edit in empathy, I mean, give me a break. That is not something we know how to do. And even if we knew how to do it, it'd be dangerous to do. Now, people also say, well, it's a slippery slope. Once you fix, you know, sickle cell anemia, you're going to start trying to fix people's IQ. Well, all slopes are slippery. That's why you got to go with caution, caution, caution. You also have to go hand in hand, step by step. And you got to say, and beyond this point, it's too dangerous to go.
Otto Isaacson, we've covered a lot of ground, and I'm happy to say that the rest of it is all in your unbelievably readable, accessible, serious, beautifully reported book, The Code Breaker.
Wow, thank you.
What have we left out, Walter?
I hope I can convey the excitement of being a scientist like a Jennifer Dowd. Now, this isn't a science textbook. This is about a kid who came home from school in sixth grade and found the double helix on her bed and embarks on a journey. And we all embark on journeys in life. When I was in college, my dad had given me the double helix. I wish I had spent more time studying biology.
So do I.
But I just think we should, yeah, we should celebrate curiosity and people like Jennifer Dowd and read her tale so they're going to understand what they've discovered. But also, Christopher, I mean, this is so much up your alley, it can spark in ourselves curiosity. Because you and I are never going to have the mental processing power of an Albert Einstein.
You're close. You're close enough, Walter.
No. I tried real hard. I'll never understand the calculus that goes with the equations for general relativity. However, we can all have Einstein's curiosity. How, as a little kid, he marveled at the compass needle that kept twitching and pointing north, even though nothing was touching it. And throughout his life, it's like, well, what's a force field? How does that work? Or be like a Jennifer Doudna who, like, looked at the sleeping grass in Hawaii growing up, and you touch it and it curls. And you and I have seen things like that. And then we're like on to, oh, look, a dead squirrel. We're on to something else. But people like Jennifer Doudna never outgrow their wonder years. It's like Leonardo da Vinci. It's like Steve Jobs. It's like Einstein or Ben Franklin. You know, Ben Franklin runs away from Boston, but when he goes across to England, he's measuring the temperature of the water and helping discover the Gulf Stream. We can all be as curious as we used to be when we were 10 years old before grown-ups said, quit asking so many stupid questions. And that's what Jennifer Doudna did, is she was always, is always curious. And then secondly, like many others you discuss, be like Steve Jobs, be like Leonardo. Connect the humanities to the sciences. That's what Vitruvian Man is all about, that naked guy doing jumping jacks in the circle in the square that Leonardo drew. It is the connection of us on Earth to the cosmos. It's the spiritual connections we have, and it's the emotional connections we have. And it's not just about science. It's about science intersecting with humanity.
That's a lot, Walter. I can't thank you enough for the book, for the conversation, for being Walter Isaacson.
Well, I would love to sit with you and we can each decide over a beer, what would we do if we could edit our genome slightly and safely? And I'm not sure I'd edit yours at all. You have a very good curiosity gene. Thank you, Christopher.
CRISPR Science is really a double search for experimental answers in the biolabs and outside them, a search for sharper questions. Ben Hurlbut at Arizona State University is a leading figure in the field of STS, science, technology, and society, with a wide-angle view of scientific history and human destiny, also social reality, and what drives this move to gene editing. The Hurlbut account of our moment starts with a counterstory to Isaacson's telling of Jennifer Doudna's triumph. His is the strange case of Dr. Hu Zhongqi, the Chinese scientist who broke a range of moral, professional, and legal codes when he created two genetically edited babies and then a third in China 2 years ago.
The He story has been told pretty much as a story of somebody going rogue. There was the responsible scientific community and there was one individual who went off the rails and went rogue. In my view, that story is a false narrative. One of the functions that that story has served is to basically externalize responsibility for what happened, draw a bright line between He and what he did and the rest of the scientific community to distance science from, you know, the project that he undertook. But in fact, he grew out of that community. He was shaped by that community. He was motivated by that community. He was, in fact, encouraged by that community or by prominent, influential members of that community. He thought that he was at the vanguard, not on a suicide mission. His aim was to be valorized, not ostracized. And, you know, I think that the right question to ask about the He story is, where did it come from? Because it can teach us something about science as such, not merely about a single individual within it.
What he was also doing was suggesting that this is a DIY world. Almost anybody who concentrates can edit the genes of embryos. There was something deeply revolutionary and scary about that, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think what he thought was that this was the future, that human genetic engineering, human genome editing was the future, and furthermore, that it was inevitable. One of the reasons he thought that was because major influential people in the field were saying things like that. The inventors of genome editing were themselves saying that it is inevitable that it would be applied to the human germline. It would be applied to human gametes and embryos and would make heritable changes.
Who said that? I mean, had Jennifer Doudna said that? George Church was notably restrained in criticizing Dr. Hu. He said, well, nobody's perfect. He didn't get it all right. But he seemed to say that's where we're going.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was said so commonly. So Doudna is one of the people who did say that. But it's said so commonly that it's sort of taken for granted. It's almost a truism that it's inevitable. But what's interesting about it is that because it was declared to be inevitable, it became a question not of whether, but of when and by whom. And He, a young entrepreneurial risk-taking scientist, all the things that scientists are supposed to be, right? He thought that this was a first that should be claimed by him on behalf of his country, China, that China should leapfrog ahead of the West in undertaking this. And, you know, he appointed himself to do it. But I think that in that role, he was sort of living up to an image of science that had been inculcated into him.
Ben Hurlbut, you worry that all kinds of scientists are leaping ahead too fast. What was wrong in what Dr. Hu did?
He conducted an experiment on children for the sake of the experiment, not for the sake of the children. And he did this in the name of scientific progress. And he did it in the name of science, in a sense, unilaterally, not as a rogue individual, but at least in his own conception, on behalf of science. Because he had the sense that science is what drives progress, science and technology, and that there is fear and resistance to change. And yet what's necessary for progress to happen is that science and technology race ahead and society will inevitably lag behind. But if somebody pushes ahead, eventually society will catch up. In fact, when I first met him, we were in a room in which a very senior scientist said something like this. And he later reported to me that that statement was really influential for him, that it gave him, as he put it, the courage to undertake this project. And yet, science does not race ahead of society. Society does not inevitably lag behind unless scientists appoint themselves to do so. And I think that's the right diagnosis of the He story. It's about self-authorization. It's about arrogance. It's about a kind of scientific unilateralism. We focus upon, we almost fetishize the science and technology of the moment, rather than asking the much larger questions that transcend any particular scientific or technological moment, but which those scientific and technological developments should be subsidiary to. We should ask them in terms of what they mean for the human, rather than asking what the human means in terms of developments in science and technology.
Coming up, more Ben Hurlbut on what feels like a turning point in civilization as well as in science. This is Open Source. In Ben Hurlbut's field of science, technology, and society, the accent is on society. With no disrespect to the scientists, the first step toward clarity on the CRISPR questions, Ben Hurlbut says, is go deeper than the heroic narratives of scientific discovery.
You know, I think there's a sense in which a kind of heroic narrative distracts us from asking more fundamental questions about what progress is, because it substitutes an account of the dynamics of scientific change and discovery for a narrative of progress. But advances in science don't necessarily mean civilizational progress. They may mean civilizational disruption or even regress, right?
I got to admit, I followed the germline editing most carefully. That's what could literally change the future of the human species. What are you learning about it? The way this story is being told, the promise of it, the scare in it, even among the scientists. I mean, how does the layman measure this storytelling?
I mean, I think that the thing that's worth paying attention to are the way the stories are told, right? Those stories have built into them unquestioned assumptions about what is good for us, about what sort of people there should be, about what forms and features of the human condition ought to be eliminated. Scholars in disability studies have made clear to us, notions of disability are not objective constructions, they're socially situated, and sometimes describing a condition as a disability is as much about marking it as an aberration that needs to be addressed as it is about anything else.
It can feel as if we're rebooting the whole history, hundreds of thousands of years, of human evolution. The question I don't understand before or after I read Walter Isaacson's book is, who's deciding the course we're on of improving the whole human species? A lot of it not represented in any of the councils of real power.
If we think of the future as made in the enclaves of elite science, we have this sort of tendency to defer to them, to in effect delegate to them the authority to decide where things go. In my view, that's a mistake. It's not that things simply happen. They happen by virtue of us stepping back and allowing them to happen. Second, the human future is at stake. But not just biologically, not just in what sorts of genomes there will be down the line, but socially, culturally, politically, morally.
Civilizationally, almost.
Civilizationally, exactly. We, in effect, look at our feet instead of asking what path it is that we're setting ourselves upon and and, you know, what its destination is. And those, to me, are the fundamental questions of governance. I like to point out that the term governance in its ancient meaning was a nautical term. It meant to navigate, to steer the ship. And we have to ask ourselves, who's at the helm? And what instruments are they navigating with? And what course are they setting? Because in a sense, we are all along for the ride.
Ben Herbert, I've heard you make a case for a kind of universal observatory of this whole field of gene editing. Educate the people, take their questions, hear their fears, hopes, redirect the ship, maybe. Can you imagine who you would put on such a board of directors of an entity that's got to represent the whole species, 7.5 billion of us?
The way the discussion about heritable genome editing has unfolded has been primarily through pretty elite groups of people.
Pretty elite. I mean, all geniuses, for one thing, and most of them rich.
It's the kind of advisory structure that tends to be deployed in these domains of technically complex esoteric science. Small numbers, committees of 15, say, that write the reports that make the recommendations that then are treated, you know, as though those are authoritative, as though those should govern. And yet, what's at stake here touches upon matters that are, you know, fundamental to the human future and therefore belong to all of us. And for that, we have to open up a broader conversation that draws upon a much richer and wider swath of human experience, wisdom, and tradition, rather than hand it to a select few. It's sort of interesting how the committees that have been assembled include people who know a lot about molecules, but know very little about kinship. They know a lot about molecular mechanics, but very little about social relations. The International Commission, which has recently issued a report laying out how heritable genome editing should be brought into the clinic, didn't include anybody who knew viscerally, experientially, personally, what it was to live with one of the sorts of diseases that they are talking about editing out. And yet those experiences are much more complex than is imagined by those who, you know, purport to be the saviors of those who suffer from such ills. And so I think the right question is, whose stories do we need to hear so that we can better understand what's at stake, and who's out there who can tell us those stories?
Don't we come down sooner or later to a question of how to get the whole population of the planet in on a decision about what's human and feeling engaged in that decision? And if you can't get anything like a representative consensus, should we be proceeding at all?
Look, I think that we have an obligation to seek after a kind of culture of deliberation around these kinds of questions, one that brings into view issues that will matter to those who are utterly unaware that these things are unfolding. For example, it's remarkably difficult to find people in the global South who are engaged with discussions around heritable genome editing. It's a sort of first world problem, you might say.
Who would you nominate, Ben Herbert, to be on the jury considering the limits of gene editing?
I don't like the idea of a jury deciding the answer. A jury is an artificially constructed body that sits in the middle of a well-developed process for arriving at a particular kind of answer, a verdict. We don't have a well-developed process because those who have played the role of advancing the frontiers of science and technology have resisted the broader conversations about what is at stake in their undertakings. And I think stories that valorize those actors, sort of heroic stories of scientific discovery, do a disservice. It treats the space of the laboratory, the elite spaces of science, as though those are the only arenas that matter for shaping the future.
What's wrong with the heroic mode of telling the story, approaching it that way?
We are awash in stories of heroic science, of innovation, of entrepreneurship, of the world transformative power of, you know, the figures who invent the future. Those stories are too easily told as though those figures are somehow outside of, or maybe better, ahead of the rest of us. Yet the very fact that we have an appetite for those stories leads us to fail to recognize the way in which science, technological innovation are embedded in a social order. Those kinds of stories, in effect, isolate and separate and elevate science and technology above society. And yet, science and technology are, or at least should be, in the service of the society of which they are part. And I think that a story that narrowly cleaves to the laboratory as the arena in which the future is made is a radically incomplete story that masquerades as a complete story. And it's one that plays into simplistic narratives that we tend to tell ourselves. For example, to say, well, I don't know enough to weigh in on what's going on inside of the laboratory. I just get carried along by the wave of scientific and technological progress. I'm a passive figure in this picture. All of which is false. All of which is false. But in a sense, it's those narratives that are the fuel that make the engines of science and technology rev.
Do we have the imagination, Ben Hurlbut, to think of a scheme in which the people of the earth, 7.5 billion of us, could rise up and tell the scientists, you're working for us, and here's our view, which we will enforce on your decision about what's human?
The question is whether we have a kind of politics that's adequate to that task, whether we, the people, in a sense, know how to see the human stakes of what seem like esoteric technical matters, and then weigh in on those stakes, because after all, it is our lives that will be shaped in the lives of our children. You know, I think that this is a challenge of the moment, to recognize the ways in which our democratic institutions, in a sense, aren't up to contending with the world-shaping power, the legislative power of science and technology. We need a new kind of constitutional imagination that recognizes the delegation of authority and the kinds of separations of power that get invoked in order to claim scientific autonomy, scientific freedom, scientific self-regulation.
Yeah, you're certainly tempted to see this as an unbelievably narrow project of, to oversimplify, a lot of rich white people and very power-minded at that, to run this past us. A buildup of heroic science in which very few geniuses will isolate manageable diseases and stop them, and then change us all in the process. Changes of eventually universal mechanics of the human brain, but also of the civilization and the society that comes with it.
You know, if you were to step back and take a problem in the world, a situation, a human situation, and ask, what's the right response to this human situation? Can you think of one that would lead you to heritable genome editing as the solution? I think it's actually pretty hard to think of such a problem. I mean, why? What is this technology for? It's a solution in search of a problem. And the remarkably convoluted and attenuated and, you know, rare situations that are held up as examples of where it would be permissible, I mean, those sort of give the lie, right? Because we always proceed unless we can give specific reasons why we shouldn't. Science is intrinsically progressive unless it bumps into somewhere where it shouldn't go, and the burden of proof is on those who would say that it shouldn't go there. Rather than recognizing that science for the sake of humanity is undertaken in the name of humanity, and what it means for humanity to benefit, it's a question that belongs to humanity, not to science. And I get it that people are impatient. People want to get on with it because they have their projects they want to do. There is an experimental frontier here that is very exciting. It's exciting to shape human lives, to feel as though you are at the helm, pulling the levers that will drive the human evolutionary future. He Zhangkui definitely felt that way, right? But the encouragement that he received from other people, I mean, remarkably significant people in the international scientific establishment, what was going on there was, among other things, the thrill of being in on something that was, you know, like the intrepid explorers who went to the far reaches of the globe in the 19th and early 20th centuries who sort of risked death for the glory of it, except that it's not their own lives that they're playing with.
These are thoughts I have every time I walk past the Koch Cancer Research Center at MIT. I always think, why not just leave your coal in the ground, Mr. Koch, and leave the genome alone? Stop polluting the air we breathe, and maybe we'd all feel better. Why not just feed every child with first-rate nutrition from day one? We might not need the genomic tweaking.
It's a pretty good idea that we would start with a question, do we need this? And then maybe move on to the question, if we think we do, what do we need it for and why? And if you don't presume that if it can come, it should come, and that it will come, if you instead recognize that it's a choice, a commitment, it's an expression of priorities and aspirations, well, you might look at it differently. And look, I mean, here we are speaking to each other over Zoom because we're in the midst of a pandemic in which an incredibly simple biological entity has brought global humanity to its knees and exposed profound deficiencies in the way we have organized our society. I mean, the U.S. was at the top of the global health security's preparedness index, right? I mean, that seems like a bad joke now. But why were we not prepared? Maybe because we invested our, well, our treasure, but also our kind of hopes, our vision for a better future into fixes that are of this sort, rather than into the much more mundane, but also in some respects more difficult challenges of taking care of our fellow human beings in the moment.
Is it possible that people, some people, maybe many people, really want the brave new world that Aldous Huxley wrote about, and that seems to be coming nearer and nearer to the way we live?
You know, I think that Brave New World is a great book to think with because it's not most fundamentally about the technologies that undergird that society. It's about the ways people in that society relate to their own lives and relate to others, right?
Yep.
It's about hedonism, and it's about pleasure, and it's about superficiality and efficiency. It's about escaping vulnerability and escaping suffering. And those turn out in that story to be dehumanizing. It's not merely the technologies that dehumanize. It's the project of human transformation that recruit those technologies that are the modes of dehumanization. And yet if we don't ask questions about what it means to be human, and that's not a question you ask and then answer and move on. It's a perpetual question, right? But if we don't ask that question perpetually, we slide into modes of dehumanization. In 1958, Hannah Arendt, in the preface to her great book, The Human Condition, wrote about technological transformations that were on the horizon, one of which was engineering human life in the laboratory. And she worried about how an emphasis on the question, you know, how can we do it, distracts from the capacity to ask why we would do it, you know, in the name of what. So she says that this sort of increase in know-how would make us, quote, unable to think and speak about things which we are nevertheless able to do. And I really like that line because in emphasizing what we are able to do, we may attenuate our capacity to think and speak together about what it means. And we need urgently to invest more energy in cultivating that capacity to think and speak together about what it means, because the attenuation of that capacity is itself dehumanizing, because that capacity, as Arendt points out, is what is defining of the human, our capacity to reflect and to understand and to achieve a kind of a politics in which we seek to do that, and a kind of narrow preoccupation, even fetishization of the spaces and the products of the laboratory is a kind of a denigration of the public sphere and the kinds of politics of thinking, speaking, and reflecting that are needed for us to understand who we are, who we ought to aspire to be, and what we as a society should do to stay human. to stay human. That is in itself an expression of the human.
Ben Hurlbut is a professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. Thanks, too, to Walter Isaacson. His new book is The Codebreaker. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from Chris Johnson and Michael Garth. Mary McGrath is our Codebreaker. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.